Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with best-selling author Eric Larson, whose most recent book is Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. We'll also talk with Lydia Pine, whose most recent book is Bookshelf. Eric Larson is one of the most beloved of narrative nonfiction writers, with 5 New York Times bestsellers to prove it. New Orleanians particularly know him for that great classic, Isaac Storm, A Man, A Time in the Deadliest Hurricane in History, and have followed him through The Devil in the White City, Thunderstruck, In the Garden of Beasts, and most recently, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. We'll be talking about Dead Wake today. Eric Larson will be coming to New Orleans April 12th to celebrate the publication of the book in paperback. Eric Larson, welcome to The Reading Life.
No, thank you very much.
Well, I should say right off the bat, though I do have a cousin named Eric Larson, we are not related.
No, we're not related.
Anyway, you said that as a Scandinavian, you do have a bit of a sea thing, and there's the troubled sea of Isaac Storm, there's a voyage that's so important in Thunderstruck, and now the doomed Lusitania and Dead Wake. You have spent a lot of time on your mental ocean, sir, I have to say.
Yeah, well, I can't say that I intended to spend all that time in, as you put it, the mental ocean, but there is for me a fundamental attraction to the sea and to maritime subjects. I mean, that's kind of what informed my decision to do Dead Wake about the Lusitania.
Now, one of the things I love about your writing is that you try to put your readers in the surround, the complete surround of whatever period you're taking on. And when you were doing the research for Dead Wake, you decided to take a cruise.
I did take 2 voyages, if you will, on the Queen Mary II, mainly because I just really felt it was important if a big part of my book was going to be a voyage on the Lusitania, detailing the whole voyage, that I really needed to get a sense of what it was like to actually be aboard a ship in the middle of the ocean. I'll tell you, it was very much worthwhile. I mean, there's nothing that quite prepares you for that feeling of, I don't want to say loneliness, but there was sort of that sense that when you're out there in the middle of the ocean, even today, something really awful happens. There's not much help that's going to be coming anytime soon.
You're really out there. I mean,
attention. Yeah. But really, it was just the overall experience of how time passes, how time compresses as you pass through time zones, the importance of things like, you know, food in your life, because, you know, there's just not that much to do aboard ship. And if you're talking about a 7-day crossing, you know, it gets boring. So food becomes very important. And so, of course, do the bars.
Now, you also spend a lot of time in the archives. You've written about how much it means to you to find actual physical evidence of things that you're writing about. And you talked about finding locks of Carl Sandburg's hair for In the Garden of Beasts. And you mentioned what a treasure trove the Cunard Lions archives are. So what are some of the archival finds and the objects that really spoke to you in this story of the Lusitania?
Well, really, one of the most important objects, because it kind of helped me decide actually to do the book, was fairly early on when I was at an archive in California. This is sort of an exploratory trip just to see what kind of material was available. And I went down to the Hoover Institution on the campus of Stanford University. And while I was there, one of the archivists put this piece of wood on the table next to me and identified it as a plank from one of the Lusitania's lifeboats, a plank that had been found next to the corpse of one of the people who did not survive the sinking. And, you know, somehow over time, this plank had made it back into the possession of the Hoover Institution. And it was really very important for me because, you know, I need tactile contact with the past. As strange as this may sound, it kind of reassures me that things actually did happen. And you get this kind of weird feeling when you touch something like that that just connects you with the past. It's very important. The archive itself is very important in that case because it did persuade me that this really would be an interesting project, mainly because there was such depth of material, such fine-grain, terrific material, even in that fairly modest archive. And I started thinking, you know, maybe there really was something that I could bring new to the party, and that was a real infusion of real-life suspense into the story.
Now, one of the things that you do so well in your books is bring the human dilemma to life, you know, and the human character and hopes and dreams and aspirations. And I was so fascinated by the story of the bookseller, Charles Laureat, on board the ship, and the rare books that were lost. This kind of broke my heart, that thread of the story.
Yeah, I really liked Laureat as a character. For one thing, what I really liked also was making the point that once upon a time, being a bookseller, especially an antiquarian bookseller, was a big-time profession. I mean, this guy was actually quite famous and was very well known on the ship and routinely took these trips in first class, you know. And the idea of a bookseller these days being able to travel first class on something like the Lusitania or the Queen Mary II, you know, it's like, oh, really? Those were the days. But I have to emphasize, people that were in the book, those who are central characters, obviously were survivors. And the reason they're in the book is just one simple reason, is that they left a lot of detail about their voyages. They left more than anybody else. So that's why he's in there. That's why the female architect Theodate Pope is there, and certain other characters.
Oh, I love Theodate Pope, too. I thought she was a great character. Oh, now as time has passed, you know, our understanding of warfare and the innovations that lead to greater effectiveness continues to evolve over time. But one of the things you make readers understand so perfectly in this book is what it was like in the world when the submarine was new.
Right.
Here came this new technology that was going to kill people.
Well, one of the things that struck me as I got into the research was the fact that the submarine was such a novel weapon. I mean, we forget now, you know, but at the start of World War I, it really was a brand new weapon. And to the extent that even the navies that ran these submarines, the British Navy and the German Navy, they didn't know how to use the submarines. They didn't realize how these things would change warfare. And, you know, if there's any kind of applicable lesson for today in this book, and believe me, I never had the intention of trying to write this book so that there would be a lesson for today, but if there were to be a takeaway, it is that, you know, when you have a brand new weapon, you just don't know what is ultimately going to happen. And, you know, with that, of course, I'm thinking about, you know, drones and even to an extent, nuclear weapons. The smaller they get, so one theory holds, the more likely they are to be used, you know. And this story about the submarine really shows how these things completely revolutionized warfare in a bad way.
Absolutely. And you talk a lot about the character of commanders, like the captain of the Lusitania, and also the commander of the U-boat, Walter Schrieger. That's an amazing thing to balance the minds of these two men throughout the story.
So, there's always, a temptation that some writers feel to exaggerate the heroicness of the hero and the villainous nature of the villain. But to me, I think it's very important to call it as it is, to call it as you see it. And one of the things I found early on was that this commander of the submarine, yes, he sank the Lusitania, but, you know, he was doing his job. Now, whether his job included sinking a passenger liner, you know, I don't know, but he thought he was doing his job. And he was actually a decent guy, you know. His crew loved him. He was kind to animals. At one point, he had 6 dachshunds aboard. He had a good sense of humor. He held a Christmas celebration in the submarine at the bottom of the sea. You know, I feel it's very important when you're writing, especially about individual characters, that is nuance. Nobody's perfect, and even total villains have a good side, except for Hitler. I make the exception for him at all times. But, yeah, so that was very important for me to try to capture an actual balanced portrait of the submarine commander and of Captain Turner. He was not an unalloyed hero either. He had his warts and he had his past problems as a Cunard commander, but in the end, a guy you would feel quite comfortable having at the helm of your ship, you know, crossing the Atlantic, or if you heard his voice, I'm sure you coming over the loudspeaker on an airplane, you would feel like, okay, good, I'm in good hands.
I wonder if you talk a little bit about the meaning of the title Dead Wake.
Yeah, dead wake is an archaic maritime term for the disturbance that lingers on the water a long time after a vessel has passed. Not the immediate wake that comes off the engine right away, you know, if people water ski behind, you know, but the disturbance that just lingers for a very long time. First of all, I like the term dead wake. It has sort of an ominous quality, but it also is very appropriate because dead wake typically could be applied to the track left on the surface of the sea by a torpedo, also the track left by a large ship like the Lusitania. You know, there's a the long, long wake that would trail behind the Lusitania was also called at one point the Cunard Highway.
What a lovely expression.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things that never struck me before, I don't know why, was that the passengers actually saw the torpedo coming. That is such a moment to imagine, and I think that must have been really a challenge to write. You just bring all the horror of that single moment right up to the top.
Well, one of the things that I was really surprised to find as I was doing the research was that passengers did see this thing coming, and that there are many accounts of this happening. I mean, I was like, oh, wow, so I have to use this because, you know, the potential for using that to enhance the suspense of those final moments before impact was very important. One salient feature of the day when this attack happened was that after the deep fog had lifted, it had left behind this absolutely beautiful spring day, very still, almost no wind other than the wind generated by the forward motion of the ship. The sea absolutely glassy and, you know, warm weather inside of the Irish coast. And the very glassiness of the sea assured that when this torpedo was coming toward the ship, it would be as visible as possible. And so suddenly, here are these passengers. This is what kind of gave me chills, was here are these passengers who's all along had been worried about, you know, would they encounter a submarine, right? Would they be torpedoed? And here they were off the Irish coast, everybody feeling safe, you know, like now we've gotten here, we've had no sign of a submarine, all's good. And then suddenly, you know, those people who happened to be in the right place at the right time on the ship were able to look off and watch this thing coming right towards them. What a strange moment that was. And one guy actually commented on how beautiful it was, because he could not only see the wake, the track of the torpedo, he could see the torpedo itself just below the surface with this efflorescence of compressed air bubbles and so forth. And he thought it was very beautiful.
I know. It's a stunning moment. Everyone should read this book because they only think they know what happened. So we've been talking with Eric Larson, whose most recent book is Dead Wake. You can meet him Tuesday, April 12th at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center. Tickets are required for this and can be purchased at Octavia Books. Eric, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you loosen love, you keep sinking all my ship. Oh, then you're the one who sank my. But somehow it don't register as pain at all. Till it finds our crooked vein, it should have.
Lydia Pine is the co-author with Stephen J. Pine of The Last Lost World, Ice Ages, Human Origins, and the Invention of the Pleistocene, published in 2012. Today we'll be talking about her new book on a very different subject. It's in the Object Lesson series, and it's called Bookshelf. Lydia is speaking to us from her home in Austin, Texas. Lydia, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful to be here, and it's wonderful to talk bookshelves with you.
Well, I love this book. It's so short, really. I mean, the essay itself is 107 pages long with many, many notes that lead the reader to further reading. But you pack so much in, going all the way back to the time of Cicero.
Yes. One of the things that was the most interesting for me working with the object lessons was the idea that there are these hidden lives as everyday objects. And so for me, part of what was really exciting about the book project was finding these underappreciated or these historical examples that we might not think of in our everyday interactions with the bookshelf.
And in the time of Cicero, bookshelves even then were a great sign of status, weren't they?
That's right. In the time of Cicero, there are two different types of libraries or reading establishments. There are the big public libraries that you would see sort of throughout the Roman Empire, but the real status symbols came from the bookshelves that would have been in a person's home. And so when Cicero is building his shelves and when other affluent Romans are building their shelves, it really is sort of being used as a way of indicating their own status to their fellow affluent Romans.
So then you take us to the chained library in Hereford, England, and I think most folks know about this early method of chaining books to bookshelves.
I think so. also, it's been an example that's kind of interesting. Some folks do know about that and are familiar with that. They've seen examples of that either popping up in popular media or are familiar a little bit with the history of books and bookshelves. But other folks, it's completely new, and it's a completely new way for them to encounter and to think about bookshelves. And so it's been interesting to sort of see the two sides to the chained bookshelves.
Well, and I love all the logistical problems that come with a chained book. You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, it was really interesting for me to be able to work with some of these chained books here at the Harry Ransom Center at UT Austin and to realize that these are heavy books. These are awkward books, that there are all of these logistics that are going to have to happen in order for the book to actually go on the bookshelf, but also for the reader to be able to take it off and to read and to interact with the book. That was one of the examples of text that I worked with that really hit home to me, that there is an incredible relationship between the type of book and the type of bookshelf that's going to be constructed for the book.
Well, that's a very dramatic moment when the archivist wheels out that very heavy book and the chain.
You know? Yes, the guy was so excited that it was just, wow, somebody actually wanted to look at this, and it's very cool, and we don't get to bring them out very often.
I know, sort of liberated at last.
And so, oh. I think it was a big moment in the reading room.
But on the other hand, you take the reader to this very contemporary library, also in Texas, in San Antonio, the Bookless Library Bibliotheque.
Which has got to earn some kind of award for brilliant naming.
Yes.
The Bibliotheque is an interesting example, I think, of sort of the plural future of bookshelves. And that's really what I came to conclude in my work with the bookshelf, is that I don't think that digital shelves are necessarily in direct competition with what we would consider physical, tangible shelves. I think that the proliferation of digital shelves, whether they're in something like the Bibliotheque in San Antonio or whether they're digital shelves on an iPad or Kindle, I think that these kind of shelves really speak to the plural future of bookshelves and that there are many kinds of shelves and many kinds of books that we're interacting with now.
I love the way you talk about how the bookshelf, the idea of the bookshelf, has become a shorthand for a whole kind of reading selection like the manager's bookshelf.
Yeah, it almost becomes this identifier, this sense of identity that it almost, as you say, it becomes a shorthand, I think, for classics or for things that ought to go on this kind of shelf, whether it's the manager's shelf or, I think one of the more interesting examples was the Laura Ingalls Wilder shelf and all of the kinds of things that one ought, sort of in those quotes, ought to see on a bookshelf that would celebrate the contemporary prairie life or the history of settlement in the U.S. West. And so I think that you're right. I think that there are definitely these identifiers and shorthands that happen in contemporary bookshelves, using it as a metaphor almost.
Well, I have to say, I have in mind myself this ideal New Orleans bookshelf.
Yeah, I was curious. What would be on the ideal New Orleans bookshelf?
Oh, well, so many cookbooks.
Well, of course.
Many cookbooks. Books about Mardi Gras, books about New Orleans histories. I mean, it's endless, but to me, it reminds me of my house pretty much.
Right.
You know, and so much of what you write about bookshelves has to do with status and also with access to knowledge.
I think that was one of the themes that became really apparent to me as I was working through the material. And I think that I first began to think about the idea of bookshelves as a tool for access to knowledge when I was working with those chained manuscripts and realized that not only does the chaining of books to their shelves offer a way to secure these really valuable books, but it also controls who has access to books, that the libraries where books are chained are not just libraries that we can wander into and peruse and take a book off a shelf, that they really have this strong sense of having to have the status or having to have the access in order to be able to use those kind of books. And that became a really interesting theme for me to explore. In what other ways do bookshelves either limit access to books or do they celebrate access to books? And I think about modern public libraries that really want readers to be able to engage with the books on the shelves. Everything from putting displays out on top or having books called out or flipped around, finding ways for readers to become excited about the books on the shelves. And that's a completely different kind of access than we see in other historical periods.
Oh, and so many libraries now want to look like bookstores. want to display books in much the same way, rather than the more traditional way of spying out and things like that. And
then you talk
a lot about library bookshelves, like the famous Snead shelves, the ones built for the New York Public Library in 1911.
The Snead shelves are amazing. I really came to appreciate the incredible history of the Snead Company, which actually started out in the mid-19th century as a company that was interested in manufacturing sort of all things iron and all things massively iron. And they made everything from girders to tea kettles to actually even spittoons. But at the turn of the 20th century, where there's sort of an interest in revamping how we think about the library and what kind of shelves would need to go into these massive libraries, there's sort of a niche, a bookshelf niche that opens up, and the Snead Company takes advantage of that, and they're able to manufacture these massive shelves, whether it's for the New York Public Library or the Library of Congress or many other institutional libraries still have and still show off their Snead shelves. The College of Physicians Library in Philadelphia, for example. And I became interested in learning more about the Snead bookshelves when I would visit these turn of the 20th century libraries and realize that every library had the same kind of shelves. I would walk through the stacks, I would look at the shelves and realize that they were all manufactured by this company. And I became really interested in what was the story of this company and how did they get interested in manufacturing bookshelves and what kind of bookshelves could they manufacture. And Snead actually held the corner in institutional sort of mass-produced bookshelves for the first half of the 20th century, and they sort of peter out in the 1960s. But even up through the 1950s, they're still filing patents for bookshelves.
And now, like everything else, you have to look for them on eBay.
Exactly.
Oh, and then, of course, you talk about where to put the shelves themselves, about whether or not, say, it's good to encourage reading in the bedroom, which is a real, you know, it's a thing.
Right. Poor Mr. James Duff Brown there.
Go ahead and explain that.
Sure, of course. So at the turn of the 20th century, the British librarian, James Duff Brown, who's actually a very prominent librarian and very big in sort of library theory of the 20th century, sort of took it upon himself to reinvent how books ought to go on shelves. He was dissatisfied, particularly with children's literature. He was dissatisfied with how categories of books were put together for children. And so he proposed that rather than sort of say books ought to be shelved according to a kid's age, like here are the books for 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds or 7-year-olds, he proposed actually that measuring sort of a child's capacity for reading would be better suited if you measured their cranial capacity. And so children with 3-ounce brains would be able to make sense of and read these kind of books, and 4.5-ounce brains would be able to read and make sense of these more complex books. The method never really caught on, needless to say, but it was interesting to sort of see that there are a lot of different ways to think about determining categories of books and how those categories of books could go on shelves. And the point that you were alluding to earlier, so in addition to his work in trying to reinvent categories for children's books, Mr. James Duff Brown actually went on to say that bookshelves had their proper place and that it wasn't in the bedroom, that books and bookshelves shouldn't be in the bedroom, that that would just lead to horrible things.
I have
but he never really elaborates as to what those horrible things are.
I have them in every room of my house.
Exactly.
And I love, too, that he put together this thing he called the small library for children. You know, and you think, it shouldn't be small. It should be as big as possible.
Exactly. But it's sort of this very small and very proper, very early 20th century. Sort of everything has its proper place, and every book on its shelf ought to have its proper place. And if we just organize it properly, then children are going to be well situated to be able to read through these proper things on proper shelves.
Well, I have to tell you, if anyone doesn't think reading's an adventure, they need to read this book and travel with you, because it's so much fun, simply so much fun.
Yeah.
We've been talking with Lydia Pine, whose charming and provocative new book is called simply Bookshelf. You'll never look at your bookshelves the same way again. Lydia, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for your time.
Here's Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Jana Levin discusses and signs Black Hole Blues and other songs from outer space. Tuesday, April 5th at 6 in the Freeman Auditorium in the Woldenberg Arts Center, Tulane University. Richard Crowell signs Chenier Plain, Wednesday, April 6th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Blood Jet Poetry Series presents Chanel Clark, Gian Smith, and With the Witness Waddington Wednesday, April 6th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Today's guest, Lydia Pine, discusses her book, Bookshelf, April 7th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jeffrey Parker discusses and signs Platform Revolution, how network markets are transforming the economy and how to make them work for you, Thursday, April 7th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop. WYES, along with the English-Speaking Union, New Orleans branch, present Carol McDee Wallace, author of To Marry an English Lord, Thursday, April 7th at the House of Roll, 2220 St. Charles Avenue. If you're suffering Downton Abbey withdrawal, here's a chance to hear from the author of one of the books that inspired the series. For tickets, go to esu.fcny.org/New Orleans. Wyming Sun, an Aramaic scholar, presents Aramaic, the Language of Jesus, Thursday, April 7th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The New Orleans Museum of Art celebrates Edible Book Month with its annual cake competition, Friday, April 8th. The event starts with viewing the gorgeous cakes inspired by books at 5:30, voting for the People's Choice favorites, continues with a cake decorating demo at 6 in Cafe Noma, and the announcement of the winners at 7. I'll be one of the judges, along with Susan Ford and Charles Brown. So come on out and see us. It's festival season in Louisiana, and the first Dave Robichaux Literary Festival, named for the fictional Cajun detective created by James Lee Burke, takes place in New Iberia April 8th through 10th. There will be walking tours, movie screenings, readings and panel discussions and food events, and a 5K run. For more information, check out DaveRobichauxLiteraryFestival.com. The Octavia Books Science Fiction Book Club discusses The Sorceress of the Wild Deeps by Kai Shante Wilson, Saturday, April 9th at 10:30 at Octavia Books. Mary Billick signs Marco Gets a Puppy, Saturday, April 9th at 11 at Barnes & Noble Mandeville. John Pope signs Getting Off at Elysian Fields, Saturday, April 9th at 1 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. LSU professor Elsie Mitchie presents a lecture, Morbidity in Fairyland, Charles Dickens, Francis Trollope, and the Rhetoric of Abolition. That's at the meeting of the Dickens Fellowship, Saturday, April 9th at 2 at Bright Library at Metairie Park Country Day School. M.O. Walsh signs a paperback edition of My Sunshine Away, Saturday, April 9th at 5:30 at the Little Gem Saloon, 445 South Rampart. John Hansen discusses and signs Farewell to an Angel, It All Began in Old New Orleans, Sunday, April 10th at 3 at Garden District Bookshop. The great William Joyce signs Ollie's Odyssey, Monday, April 11th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Raif Shwari discusses and signs Beirut on the Bayou, Alfred Nicola, Louisiana, and the Making of Modern Lebanon, Monday, April 11th at 6 at Octavia Books. Carol Devine discusses and signs Sleeping Between the Rails, A Woman's Odyssey, Monday, April 11th at 6 at the Nunez Community College Auditorium. That's just before the History Lecture Series program showing of the documentary film Delta Justice, The Isleños Trapper Wars. And today's guest, Eric Larson, discusses and signs his new paperback, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania, Tuesday, April 12th at 7 at the Uptown Jewish Community Center, 5342 St. Charles Avenue. Tickets are available at Octavia Books. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.